are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. From a teen vampire cult that killed one member's parents to naked people who tell cops, nothing to see here, Frank Stanfield has seen it all in 30 years as a newspaper editor and reporter, mostly in Florida. Vampires, gators, and wackos, a newspaper's man's life, recalls rustlers hiding ranchers' bodies in a bottomless pit and a Jane Doe so mauled people believe it was a bear attack. It exposes cops who bungle murder cases and praises those who are heroes. There are tales of bears, sharks, snakes, alligators, and pot-bellied pigs. There is the teacher who is too pretty to go to jail despite having sex with a middle school male student. Hurricanes lash out, tornadoes spin a blender of death, and sinkholes swallow homes, roads, and people. All of this takes place while newspapers, with their own zany characters, are fighting for their survival. The book that we're featuring this evening is Vampires, Gators, and Wackos, A Newspaper Man's Life, with my special guest journalist and author, Frank Stanfield. Welcome back to the program, and thank you so much for this interview, Frank Stanfield.
Thank you, Dan. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, and congratulations on this book. It's pretty well a good slice of your life as a journalist and the incredible stories that you covered as a reporter and journalist. Let's talk about your background first and how you got started in journalism and your first assignments before we talk about one of the more spectacular cases that you turned into a book, Cold Blooded, that we discussed May 2021, Cold Blooded. But before that, tell us about your background and how you became a journalist.
Well, I grew up in the Midwest before we came to Florida. And so I came from a family of storytellers, you know, oral storytellers. And I always wanted to write. So when I had a chance to go to college and I took political science and journalism classes, and I got my first job was at the Augusta Chronicle in Georgia. And it was like a real eye opener. I said, this is what I've got to do. This absolutely has my name on it. So that's the way it started. And they let me cover the cops quite a bit. So that was my favorite thing of all.
You talk about your early experience at a KKK rally. Tell us about that.
Oh, brother. Yeah, this was when, this goes way back to when Jimmy Carter was president. And some idiot drove his car through a KKK rally over in Plains, Georgia, where the Jimmy Carter's from. So they had another one of these rallies. This is ugly, ugly stuff, these people. And they had a rally in Augusta. So my editor says, okay, we're going to go, but we're not going to write about it. We're not going to give any ink to these people. But I want you there just in case something happened. So I went and I introduced myself, and that the guard runs off to get the grand poobah for an interview, thinking I want to interview him or something. And I kind of wander around and I get a sick feeling looking at these people and listening to their rants and the burning the cross. And it was a real sickening thing, but nothing happened. So I went back to my office, and the next day the folks call and says, well, hey, what about this reporter? He didn't write anything. And my city editor had the wherewithal at least to say, well, she didn't give me give them my phone number, address, what time I left work, and all that sort of thing. So at least she didn't do that. So that was good.
Now, you talk about this case, and I just mentioned it, the one that you turned into a book in 2021, Cold Blooded, the case of Rod Farrell, 16-year-old vampire. We could go into this case and take the entire hour to talk about that, but this case, you became part of it largely. You mentioned that after some very fine reporting on behalf of your fellow journalist, this became largely your case. Just tell us about the most incredible part of this most incredible tale.
Well, Rod Ferrell was only 16 years old, but he had the charisma and the drive to form a cult, a vampire cult. And these guys were drinking each other's blood and doing all these odd things. And so they come down to Florida to pick up one of their cult members. He had gone to school here at one point, came back, picked her up and killed her parents. And she left with them and they were all caught 3 days later. But she was not indicted. The rest of them were indicted. So the sheriff was like, this ain't right, you know.
Yeah.
And what role did she have in all this? I mean, that was kind of the mystery of the whole thing. And it was an outrageous case. And of course, it made international headlines. It was just so outrageous.
Mm-hmm. You talk about another case, and it's the missing millionaire, the title of the, I believe, of the chapter. But it's Robert W. Ford. And you have it that a person got away with murder. Tell us a little bit about this incredible story that you've included.
This was wild. This is back in the early 80s. This fellow by the name of Neil Haber, who was a builder, developer here, and lived in Leesburg, Florida. And he had come back from Mexico and went home. And then about a day or two later, he was reported missing and in his car. He had some fancy car. And so where was he? You know, and the stepson, this Robert Ford, told this really messed up story. Like he heard something, but he didn't really see the people. And he saw there was blood in the garage. So he just kind of wiped it down and he found blood on a tarp. So he threw that in a dumpster. And the cops messed this up every way you can mess it up. And they basically just, this Robbie Ford, who was the stepson, just got away with murder. And the cops, in their effort to try to solve this thing, got real cozy and friendly with the widow and with her suddenly brand new business partner,
mm-hmm.
Who had just been a gopher before. So the whole thing made headlines every day. And the family took out a full page out of the newspaper, a reward for return of the car. Not for yeah. him. They wanted the car.
Yeah.
The next day they said, oh no, we want him too, of course. Well, they found him in the car in an orange grove after he'd been in there for several days. And in Florida, that's not a good thing. So nobody wanted the car after that.
Yeah.
But basically the man had possible mafia ties, business dealings. He had some very odd accounting system, a lot of liquid cash. So there was like several different possible motive suspects. So it was very interesting.
You have a chapter called Cases That Keep Cops Awake at Night. And that's an understatement. And one, Trenton Duckett in August 2006. And a woman named Melinda calls 911. Tell us a little bit about this Trenton Duckett.
Trenton was about 2 years old. And she calls the cops and she reports him missing. She says, oh, I went to check on him. And then I went to, had some friends over watching TV. I went back to check on him again. And the window screen was cut open. This was an apartment complex. He was gone. So the next day, Nancy Grace calls and asks her, well, what was he wearing? What were you doing? And the mom says, you know, she was very vague. She said, we were just running around, whatever. And when she called the 911 operator, the 911 operator said, well, what was he wearing? And she says, I don't know or whatever. I don't remember or something like that.
Right.
And the whole thing was fishy from the beginning. Well, then, so after Nancy Grace interviews her and gets no answers, before the interview airs, she goes over to her grandparents' house and kills herself.
Right.
So now nobody knows where he is. If he was killed, where's the body? If she handed him off, which some police officers thought, where is he?
Mm-hmm.
And the another twist of this whole thing is this kid's grandfather is on death row for killing a kid. you know, former, he was a cop too. So that's another whole twist.
Yeah, incredible.
Yeah, and keeping in that theme, you have another chapter called Killer Cop, and you have Teresa May Maccabee, which is 11-year-old. This is May 1987. She's out for an errand to buy a pencil, and she bumps into the last witness, sees her with a 16-year-old Mexican boy. But that person that witnessed it is a police officer. Tell us a little bit more about this tale.
Right. And that's the grandfather of this Trenton, who is born years later, of course. Mm-hmm. He's a rookie cop, a little bitty town in South Lake County, which is outside of Orange County where Disney World is and all that. But yeah, he doesn't make a lot of sense either. He's not, the police chief tells him, you get out there, you hunt for this kid, you know, no matter what else is going on. But the next morning, he's out there doing traffic stops and whatnot. He's not doing what he's supposed to do. He didn't put flyers out like he was supposed to do. And they found tire tracks by this lake where they found the little girl's body. And the tire tracks matched the patrol car. So he gets arrested. He swears he didn't do it and all this. And there's been a whole years of controversy about DNA. They found hair on her. Well, is it his or not? And for a long time, the technology didn't allow him to test it. Now they can test it, but he doesn't want it tested because he says that it will destroy the only sample. Well, okay, whatever. So he's on death row still.
You have a chapter called Mother Nature Runs Amok, and you also include stories of hurricanes and talk about, I believe it's Tampa, is the lightning capital of the world, I believe.
Yeah.
Tell us about some of these incredible stories and why you included in a story in a book that's about murder and death and some killing.
Well, Mother Nature can be a pretty wicked killer too. I talk in this book about what happened on Groundhog Day. There was a tornado that came through a little town outside the village's retirement community called Lady Lake and Lake Mac, and it killed 21 people. And I mean, it was devastating. The whole landscape, it picked up these old double-wide trailers that the older folks lived in, some of them, and just rolled them across the landscape, just killed them, and snapped trees off. It sucked people out of their house. One of the things that I saw, the first thing was a man sitting where his brick house was. Mm. He's just sitting there in a chair. The house is completely gone.
Wow.
He was asleep on the mattress. He heard his wife scream in the other room. He said, the next thing I know, I'm floating in the air and I'm looking up at the stars because there's no roof in the house. That kind of thing. So, and then the hurricanes, it was 2004. There was like five hurricanes back to back to back to back to back. And, you know, when you cover those things, there's two ways to do it. You can sit in the emergency shelter and just wait for the thing to be over with, or you can pick your moments and get out and try to cover it like you should be covering it. And that's what my photographer and I did. And those things are so dangerous. We tried to get back every night before it got dark because you can't see tree limbs and road signs flying around the dark. But at the last day of the last storm, she went back to the car to get something out of the car, and a tree limb snapped, big tree limb, and just missed her. So they're very deadly. And we saw a lot of destruction, a lot of property damage, a lot of people just scared to death by those things, with good reason.
Absolutely. You include a story, Jane Doe, Bottomless Pit, 1991, in Rock Springs Run Reserve, and a body's found. And we mentioned this in the introduction, that it was brutalized so badly the rumor was that she'd been mauled by a bear. Tell us a little bit about this Bottomless Pit and Jane Doe.
Yeah, there's actually two stories there. The Bottomless Pit is one story and the Jane Doe is the other. I kind of put them together in one chapter. But Jane Doe, after the the crime scene people get to looking at the body, which was buried under some limbs and things. That's what people, I think, initially thought she'd been killed by a bear. They realized the body had been posed, that she had been, someone had, I don't know how to say this, had placed a bottle, a broken bottle, where something like that should not be, mm-hmm. and had posed her hand pointing to it. And she was had been bitten and torn up, just torn up. And so years later, a few years later, again, this is all when DNA stuff was pretty new. A analyst, crime scene analyst, is feeding the male DNA found on her body through a computer, a crime computer. And all of a sudden there was a hit, and it was on a convicted rapist. So, wow, that was like a big moment right there, because the police had gone everywhere, done everything they could. They even went to all these topless bars in Orlando and thinking she was maybe a dancer or something, to see, you know, to try to identify her. They never did identify her, but they identified the killer. They had a trial. They brought in this bite mark expert who helped put Ted Bundy away.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he testified, so that was a big deal. The bottomless pit thing, Lake County, where I do my work, is outside of Orlando. And it used to be especially very rural. So Florida, at one time, I don't know if it still does or not, has more cattle than Texas.
Wow.
So there's a lot of ranches and stuff. And so these two ranch owner and a foreman were out there because they were looking for missing cows. They were missing some cows. So it turns out that a couple of these ranch hands shot them and threw them in this so-called bottomless pit. They have these sinkholes in Florida that are full of water. Nobody knows how deep they are, but they weighted their bodies down with concrete blocks and threw them in there. And then they figured out, you know, who these guys were. And of course, one of them had a conscience, because he says, the cop says, well, you know what happens to a body in water, meaning alligators.
Mm-hmm.
And so the guy broke down and confessed, and they got the bodies. When they pulled the bodies out, they also found an old Duesenberg that had been used in a bank robbery in the 1920s in this place. So this is a kind of a place that criminals use to dump all their stuff. So that was a very interesting case too.
You also include a case of a six-year-old girl named Kayla missing, Kayla McKean. Tell us what's important about this story and why you included it.
Well, Kayla was, I think she was five or six. I can't remember. I think she was five. And her dad reports her missing on Thanksgiving. And hundreds of people show up to look for her and all this sort of thing. Well, this goes on for like 3 days, people looking at, and the cops suspect that he did it all along. This is a kid that he didn't even know he had this girl until his estranged girlfriend tried to get child support.
Yeah.
Well, he killed her. But here's the thing. This case was messed up every way you can mess up as far as the child welfare system goes.
Right.
You had DCF people going out there and saying that they investigated this or that, and they didn't. You had every kind of breakdown of the system you could think of. The only people that were doing it right was the school where the little girl went to school. And they were reporting things like, okay, she comes to school with makeup on to hide a black eye and that kind of thing. So yeah. The school was the only one that did it. And so basically, because of this case, they had to redo the entire child welfare laws, the way things were done, how investigations are done, and so on. So that was a major, major thing.
Just like in the introduction, this chapter is called Gators and Other Monsters. Tell us about some of the stories that are included in this Gators and Other Monsters chapter.
One of the things I talk about, I interview this fella. He's a shark expert at the University of Florida. And they talk about, well, there's a lot of shark attacks. Most of them are not fatal, but some of them are. And also some of them are so hideous, tiger sharks on the West Coast, that people are like damaged for life because of it. But he talks about, he had an interesting spin on this. He says, well, people are catching these sharks now, cutting their fins off and, you know, throwing the rest of the shark back. So he says, well, who is who's hunting who here? And so you've got people worried about the shark population now of all things. But what we had several instances in Florida over the years of people being killed by alligators. These things are monsters. They're huge, 12, 13 feet long. They can get to be several hundred pounds. So there was one little boy over in Volusia County who was standing on the edge of a lake with his parents. And all of a sudden, just the water ripples, the snap, and he's gone. He's done. So we did a story. We had a cable show, the Orlando Sentinel, where I worked at the time. And we went out with a game and fish guy on this airboat. And we were talking about alligators, and this is a big habitat and so on. And a three-footer swims up to the boat. And so the game and fish guy says, do you want me to catch him? And we said, sure, you know. So he's holding him, and the gator, little gator's making these noises like, mama, help me, you know, that kind of thing. So the wind is blowing us out to the middle of the lake. And so we're done. And he says, well, I can't let him out here because, you know, he'll just be food for other alligators, bigger alligators. So he says, here, you hold him while I get back to the shore. I'm going like, say what now? Because he's wiggling around and carrying on. And my photographer was laughing so hard, I thought she was going to fall overboard. So they're out there. They're very common, but people don't have any sense. If you ever feed an alligator, you get in the habit of, an alligator gets in the habit of being around people. They lose their fear of people. They're very, very dangerous.
And you talk about as well, people should know, and before they go out, swimming at night is not a good idea. That's when they come out.
No, that's when they come out. There's certain feeding times. And I was talking about a teenage boy that was killed by an alligator too, and an elderly woman, because they were just swimming in a place that they're full of alligators, and somebody, in a couple of cases anyway, have been feeding these alligators, which just encourages them to come around. They're big, and they've got a brain the size of a walnut, I think. They're not real smart. They're just made for killing. That's what they are.
Yeah. You have a chapter called Cops, and Sarah Heckerman is a Lake County Sheriff dispatcher on February 2005. And it involves Jason Wheeler, who's 29 years old. And her boyfriend had hogtied her and raped her and threatened to kill her. And she called, 911. Tell us a little bit more about this incredible story involving cops.
Yeah, Heckerman, she wasn't a dispatcher, but she called the cops. She was living in the woods, in the forest, I should say, with this guy, Wheeler. And they had some children together between them. So she calls the cops, says, well, now, he hog-tied me. If you come with lights and sirens and all, he'll kill you. So she says, I'm leaving the house. I'm going to go down to a friend's house, walk down the road or whatever. So the cops get there and they send three deputies. And so they pick her up. They go to the house and they're looking for him. Basically, they're living in a camper while they're fixing up their house, which was damaged in a hurricane. He ambushes the whole lot of them and kills one deputy and injures two others. There's a big gun battle. He somehow escapes on a motorcycle and then goes out and hides in the woods. And that now there's a massive manhunt for this guy. And he stands up on this little island in a lake, and a deputy shoots him. And he ends up being paralyzed for life. Well, so he goes to trial, and now he's repentant. He says, "I was sinful. I was doing all these terrible things, and I'm sorry, and all that." But the judge and the jury recommended death penalty. Well, here's the interesting thing about these cases: Florida now, I guess everywhere, a jury, 12-member jury, has to be unanimous
right
in their recommendation for a death sentence. So he's coming back for resentencing, just like so many of these other people are coming back. So he gets another shot. Is he going to get off death row or not? But people have a pretty dim view of people that ambush and kill police officers around here. So,
absolutely. Let's use this, Frank, as an opportunity to stop for a second to hear from our sponsor, which is ZipRecruiter. According to the latest research, 90% of employers plan to make enhancing the employee experience a top priority in 2022. After all, a happy workplace is key to attracting and keeping great employees. A few ways employers can make their employees happier is to make them feel more valued, offering them, for example, more learning opportunities and allowing possible flexibility in their work schedules. And if you need to add more employees to your team, there's ZipRecruiter. Their matching technology helps you find the right people for your roles fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/murder. ZipRecruiter uses its powerful technology to find and match the right candidates up with your job. Then it proactively presents these candidates to you. You can easily review these recommended candidates and invite your top choices to apply for your job, which encourages them to apply faster. No wonder ZipRecruiter is the number one rated hiring site in the U.S. based on G2 ratings. ZipRecruiter's technology is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Find the right employees for your workplace with ZipRecruiter. Try it for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/murder. That's ZipRecruiter.com/MURDER. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Now, Frank, we have another chapter, and you describe it as ruthless, or you name it, title it as ruthless, featuring certainly a ruthless killer, Fred Anderson Jr. And in this particular story, especially, you talk about that you got the call. Tell us a little bit about this call that you got and this assignment and the Fred Anderson Jr. and ruthless.
Right. It was on a Saturday morning. I wasn't feeling that great, you know, nothing serious, but just sort of like, I don't know, not feeling great. So my editor, of course, calls and she says, I think there's like a couple of people murdered in a store, I think, in another town. So she says, let me call you right back. So then she says, well, there's been a shooting at a bank over in Mount Dora, which is a beautiful little town. And so maybe one of them's dead, maybe one of them's still alive. I'm not sure. So I jump in the car and go. That's the last time I thought about not feeling great, because you get focused, you know?
Yeah.
So I get over there and the helicopter's taken off with air rescue. And there's one fella is holding his head and screaming and says, she just was trying to, you know, make a living, and people are freaking out and the cops are everywhere. So it turns out, I asked the leading police officer over there. I says, okay, tell me what's going on. And he said, well, one of them is dead. The bank teller is dead. And we arrested the suspect inside the bank. And one of them, then he says, now the other one's dead. So I go back to the office and start writing the story, which is nearby. Start writing the story. And then I send the story in. And then somebody from Orlando calls and says, well, she's not dead. The second person's not dead. What this guy had done, he pretended to be a college student doing research on the banking business.
Right.
He goes in there, hangs around on Friday afternoon to scope the place out, comes back on Saturday, and basically robs this bank, tells the tellers to go back and open the vault and everything, which they do. They do everything that he's supposed to, he had asked them to do. And then he shoots them anyway. He says, which one of you guys want to die first? And then just start shooting. Well, then he tries to get the security camera video out of the machine.
Incredible.
And when the cops come in, he's standing next to a garbage can full of cash. I mean, a lot of cash. I forget how much it was, $70,000 or something like that, maybe more. And then, but his mistake was that one of the ladies lived. She was paralyzed for life.
Yeah.
But when she testified in the trial, she comes down the middle aisle there in the courthouse, in the courtroom, in a motorized wheelchair. You could hear a pin drop.
Sure.
And she says, and she tells the story, which one of you guys want to die first? So his defense, he was, this is so messed up. His defense, he sang in church choir. So his defense is he sings a song on the witness stand about mercy. And the prosecutor says, this man doesn't deserve any mercy because he didn't give these ladies any mercy.
Yeah.
And the jury agreed. And that was it for him. That was a terrible crime.
Well, you talk about a case where a drug dealer who's 22 years old, Eloy Benavidez, and this huge person named Ron Ridgway, 515-pound bodyguard for this gang leader named Diaz.
Right.
Tell us why you included this story and what's so fascinating about this case.
This was a good chance to take a look at a big international drug gang. They were, living in the forest and living large too. They were taking their own product and smoking it and snorting it too. But what happened here was this drug dealer, Benavidez, goes out to this drug stash house because they owe him money. They owe him about $500,000, I believe it was. I can't remember. And he's there to collect. And so what they do instead is they have a guy on the roof with a rifle and they shoot him. And then they bury him. And then they make a concrete pad over him and make a dog pen out of it. These guys are just ruthless. I mean, they're leaving bodies everywhere. They're shooting each other and in the forest and everything else. So Ron Ridgway is one of the enforcers, bodyguard, whatever. He's 505 pounds. And his lawyer says, well, Ron, are you losing any weight in the jail? He says, no, I'm gaining weight. And his baby brother was 485 pounds.
Sure.
But these guys are just absolutely ruthless, and they're shipping money, drugs. They're bringing it in. They're bribing inspection people at the airport in Texas, and then they're shipping it all over the country. And then they're bringing in cocaine from Puerto Rico. So this whole thing, you know how this goes. Once they start making arrests, people start flipping on each other.
Mm-hmm.
And one guy, this Puerto Rican hitman, he gets scared in a pretrial hearing, and he's afraid he's going to get the death sentence. So he just, without any negotiation or anything else, pleads guilty straight up to first degree murder.
Yeah.
And it happened so fast, everybody in the courtroom wasn't sure that the court reporter got it. So they subpoena my notes. And I said, well, good luck reading them, first of all. But I had him down as doing it. So, but these guys they would just kill each other at the drop of a hat. It was just incredible.
You include a chapter called Jessica and February 24th, 2005. Father Mark Lunsford comes home and his 9-year-old daughter, Jessica, is missing from her room. He's staying with his parents, right? Or his parents, her grandparents, and there's no sign of forced entry. Tell us about this remarkable case and how it winds up in the end regarding a law.
This is a horrible case too. She was actually six. The dad had gone and spent the night with his girlfriend. He leaves Jessica with his parents, which are nice people. And this is a small area. This is Homosassa Springs over in Citrus County. Nice area. But so what happened was they didn't know. They searched and searched and searched for a long time. And finally, they have an idea that this already convicted sex offender was staying in a mobile home where he wasn't supposed to be staying with a sister nearby. It turns out this guy had broken in at night. The house apparently was not locked. Brought her over to the trailer. His story is he got scared and basically buried her alive.
Yeah.
Just horrible. And so this is one of those. And again, the cops kind of mess it up because they forget to Mirandize him, or they question him without telling the lawyer they're going to do it, and all this sort of thing. So there's a big controversy about it. And then because they would have a hard time finding a jury that wasn't familiar with this case in this small area, they moved the trial to Miami. That's another whole thing. But this guy, James Cooey, Cooey is his last name, just a worm. You look at him and you go, just how disgusting and how awful. And so they come up with new legislation, making all this kind of these kinds of child abduction and by convicted sex offenders harder sentencing and all that sort of thing. So again, it changes the law. But it was just a heartbreaking case because she was just a beautiful girl that was just being compliant. That he says, "Come with me." So she, being obedient little girl, she follows him, and it's just awful. It's just heartbreaking.
And the confession, as you say, it's disgusting, but it is one of the most disgusting yet detailed, unfortunately, confessions. It's heart-wrenching to even read it. It's so disgusting and so brutal and senseless. And you also write that Bill O'Reilly, the conservative pundit, was outraged over this case, wasn't he?
Made a lot of dinner. Yes, he was. Yeah. What Bill was talking about was they didn't charge the sister. They said, surely she knew that something was going on or whatever. Mm-hmm. And her roommates, I mean, they had to, why didn't they prosecute them? You know, they were as accessories or something. Well, the prosecutor, Brad King, at the time, he says, look, I can't, there's no evidence to show that they were aware of it. Cooey, such a messed up character. He says, no, I had her locked up in the closet for days and all that. And the prosecutor said, that's impossible. So basically, they didn't charge the roommate, the sister. So that's what upset Bill O'Reilly. But the prosecutor says, look, she gave permission to search the house. And because the confession was thrown out, if she hadn't agreed to verbally allow them to search the house, they wouldn't have had a case anyway. So it turns out it ended up being okay. But yeah, Bill O'Reilly was, he was hot. So it was just another one of those terrible cases. So much of that stuff goes on in Florida. I think because people come to Florida, they don't have a family structure here. Their family's somewhere else.
Right.
And they're just at loose ends. And, there's a lot of drugs going on, and it's just, I don't know, people just kind of lose their minds down here sometimes. Crazy.
Wow. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages. Now, you talk about people losing their mind in Florida, and appropriately, you have a chapter called Crazy, and you feature a woman named Diane Evers on January 1st, 1980, bathing her two twin daughters and her two-year-old. What happens?
She, her family's in the living room. She's bathing these twins, and so the girl, young girl, and they go to check on her, and then to their horror, realize that she's drowned the children in the bathtub.
Yeah.
She says she's the Virgin Mary, and that she has all these delusions about doctors saying this or that to her, nurses saying this or that, and she pleads, not guilty by reason of insanity. It's one of those rare cases. That's a rare defense anyway, because juries don't like it. Buy it. But in this case, it worked. She was institutionalized until just a few years ago. And now she's graduated to a halfway house or, you know, kind of step down facility.
Mm-hmm.
But, the judge, the monitoring this whole thing for years, that what would happen is under the law, you get a right to, you know, if the mental hospital says, oh, she's better now, you get a hearing, and then the judge decides. Well, every time they were about to have a hearing, she would, what they call, decompensate. And one time she tried to saw her arm off with a saw.
Wow.
And that kind of thing. So they needless to say that they canceled that hearing. But it's like, that is true craziness. But there's other cases in this book where people act crazy, say crazy things, do crazy things, but it's not the judge or whatever decides, no, that's not crazy. That's just, it's not that crazy. There's crazy, then there's crazy, you know, that kind of thing. So sorry about your luck. You're going to jail. So, and then I've covered other cases where that's actually been the defense. But it, like I say, it's rare. It rarely works. The jury just doesn't buy it.
You say one of the strangest cases you helped cover was in 2002, a nationally publicized case of a woman diagnosed with 12 different personalities, dissociative identity disorder. Tell us a little bit about why you think this is one of the strangest cases other than the obvious.
Well, it's so rare that some psychologists don't even believe it's real. Mm-hmm. Rod Farrell, the vampire, he claimed to have it. Of course, he didn't. But this woman, her deal was, she said that she was sexually abused by her psychiatrist, that she had these different personalities. One of them was a promiscuous young woman who she would be having sex with his doctor. And then she would, as she puts it, come to, and then realize that she was being abused.
Yeah.
And, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And during the testimony of this case, she slipped from one identity to another in the courtroom. And so because the defense attorney was asking questions, and she goes, How are you doing? You know, that kind of thing. And he says, who am I talking to now? And then she snapped out of it and went back to her main persona or whatever. So the end result was that it was very odd to see. But the end result was that the psychiatrist was acquitted, but the state yanked his license anyway. Right. So that was interesting.
Yeah.
But to see something like that happen right in front of your eyes is, it's like weird. It's like Sybil and Three Faces of Eve and those kind of things. Very odd.
Yes, indeed. You have a chapter called Baby-Faced Killers, and you have a middle school troubled kid with a 9mm semi-automatic handgun about to confront his tormentor, or at least that's what he says. Tell us about this controversial case.
Yeah. Keith Johnson, he says this, he's being bullied or, you know, tormented or whatever by this other kid. And so he's 15. Maybe he's 14 at the time of the crime. I can't remember, but
yeah.
I think he's 15 when he goes to trial. So he shows up. He's staying. He's got all kinds of problems. Here's the thing. All these cases, you can look at their home and say, well, okay, I get it. I actually taught middle school for 1 year, and I would see these kids going off the wall. And what's going on here? And then I get the parents in there. I say, okay, I get it now.
Yeah.
So this kid, he got kicked out of his house because he stole his mother's car and drove to New York with his girlfriend. So he's having to stay with some family friend. Well, the family friend had a gun, and he got hold of the gun, took it to school, and shot this kid, Joey Summerlin, shot him several times. And the controversy was, he says, I was in fear of my life. I thought he was going to kill me, blah, blah, blah. Other people said, well, no, he was just running his mouth and that kind of thing. So, but the thing of it is, the only sentence and the jury found him guilty, the only sentence you can have for something like that was mandatory life. He was 15 years old. Well, now the Supreme Court keeps moving the ball. Okay. And so now the Supreme Court says, no, if you're a juvenile when you commit murder, you don't automatically be sentenced to life. Right. You're entitled to a new sentence and all that jazz. So he is coming back for another sentencing hearing. I don't know when exactly. They keep putting it off because the COVID has pushed everything back so much.
Right.
We're just now having trials on cases from 2017, that kind of thing. But so was he justified in doing what he did in his mind? You know, that's a question. But it, you know, even though it was horrible, and you're thinking 15 years old and you're going to spend the rest of your life in prison, that's a big one to chew off, you know?
Absolutely.
So there's other cases too where it was an accidental shooting and the kid gets sentenced under juvenile law, which of course is a lot different, okay? You can be sentenced to confinement, but by the time you're 21 or whatever, you're out of there. Another case where a kid shot his sister and the legal system found a way to kind of hit some kind of happy medium with a lot of counseling and so on that one, because basically the parents were going to lose both of their children, you know? So it's, I think you're going to see a lot of more hand-wringing and people trying to figure out some way of dealing with these kids because they're out there and they're killing, and what do you do with it, you know?
Absolutely. You have another chapter called Love Hurts, and this is a 21-year-old Jolene Fisher and her ex, Tony Fisher, and that she's at her grandparents' house. She's afraid of Tony. Tell us what happens in this chapter, Love Hurts, and this Jolene Fisher and Tony, her ex.
She comes home, I guess from a date, comes home with a friend anyway. We'll call it a date.
Yeah.
So he's walking her to the door. She gets in the door and the door slams behind her. And it's her husband in there. And he's got a knife and some guns. And he's trying to cut her throat. So she's putting her hands up to try between the blade and her throat to keep getting her throat cut.
Yeah.
And they're wrestling around. And the friend runs next door to get some help. He comes and smashes the door in and gets in there. And then the cops come. Well, she has such severe cuts all in her hand that it takes a special surgeon hours and hours and hours to try to reattach the nerve endings, to try to attach all the tendons, all that were cut. It was just horrific. But the interesting thing was, in the trial, she looks at him square in the eye and says, you know, she says, I know that I'm supposed to be a victim, but I'm not going to be a victim. I'm not going to do it, you know, and you're going to go away to jail and I'm going to get on with my life, basically. So kudos to her. She had a lot of guts and she was bound and determined to keep healing and to go on with her life. So that was quite a story.
You have other shocking examples of similar cases, and you have a Corey E. Brown claiming it was an accident, but her head was bashed against with a brick or against a brick wall. You have other cases as well. You have another chapter called Dead Men Talking. Tell us what story might be involved or is included in Dead Men Talking.
That's one I'm really proud of because I got a tip. There was the city of Mount Dora, which I say is a beautiful little town. It's kind of a tourist place that it looks like an MGM set for a whole musical or something. Beautiful place. Well, there had been a series of stabbings and robberies and assaults and one murder and of an old man. So I got a call. There was a man found dead in his house. So the cops are calling it a natural death. So I get a tip, though, from somebody. He says, this is not natural. It's homicide. So I get to looking into it. I talked to the man's girlfriend. There were obvious signs that the house had been broken into. The circumstances, the crime scene looked really fishy. He was like on his knees, and there was a pillow nearby. And then there was a knife nearby, and then the cops come, and they move the knife to take crime scene pictures. I'm going, what's going on here? So I kept doing these stories, investigative stories, and got a lot of pressure on the prosecutor's office. And they got to the point where they got a court order, exhumed the body, and found out that, yes, he had been murdered. And the guy confessed to the murder. He got convicted for second-degree murder. It was a gang of teenagers out there, and they just wanted to rob. And one of them says, we just want to do old people. And so just ruthless, terrible people.
Yes, absolutely. You have a chapter called Senseless, and certainly it chronicles a senseless murder that the name is an understatement. But you also have a couple chapters, the last two chapters, Death Knell for Newspapers and Dreams. So tell us about a little bit about Death Knell for Newspapers, and your dreams regarding that.
Well, I've been in this business actually now 40 years. And I mean, from the days when it was like the newspaper was extremely powerful and influential to now the massive layoffs. The newspaper business was not fast in getting up to speed with the internet and all that. Right. They've just lost so much. Mm-hmm. So they're sort of hanging on. They're doing the best they can, but I mean, there's only a few people here in Lake County. I'm one of them, and I'm not full time, but I'm working on covering trials and so on. But my dream, I have this recurring dream where I'm at I'm on the copy desk and I'm trying to put out the paper, but I don't have a list of the stories. I don't know what pages are supposed to go on. It's all confused. And there's people in there from different papers, you know, like from the Sentinel and from the Ocala Star Banner and that kind of thing. I'm going like, well, what does this mean? Well, it just means that I've left a lot of friends behind over the years.
Right.
And a lot of people have moved on. And so that's kind of what I'm thinking, that it's your subconscious tries to put all these things together. The thing of it is, when you put your heart and soul in something, like I have in journalism, then it's really hard and disturbing to see, you know, these things fall apart. So that's what it's about.
Absolutely. And you do talk about, and I agree, you know, the face of journalism has changed, and maybe they were late getting a digital version of what they were doing, but it's essential that they do. And regardless of whether that change is dramatic and not to be ever the same in terms of newspapers and their readership, but that it's necessary, and the same honored art of journalism is necessary today and will be in the future. So it'll just have to reinvent itself somewhat, won't it?
Yes, it will.
I want to thank you very much, Frank, for coming on and talking about vampires, gators, and wackos, a newspaper's man's life, Frank Stanfield. For those that might want to take a look at this book and other work, can you tell us about a web page or Amazon page that they might take a look at?
Frankie Stanfield at frankiestanfield.com, and I'm on Facebook and Twitter on my name.
Thank you very much, Frank. Vampires, Gators, and Wackos, A Newspaper Man's Life. Thank you very much, Frank Stanfield. You have a great evening. Good night.
Thank you.